Welcome to High Impact Growth, a podcast from Damagi about the role of technology in creating a world where everyone has access to the services they need to thrive. I'm Amy Vaccaro, Senior Director of Marketing at Damagi and your co-host, along with Jonathan Jackson, Damagi's CEO and co-founder. Today, Jonathan and I have the pleasure of interviewing Raj Kumar, the founder and editor-in-chief of DevEx, which is the premier news outlet for all things happening in global health and development. The conversation starts with Raj's take on how 2023 will usher in a new era for development, given converging political, economic, and humanitarian factors. And it evolves to a discussion of how we might shift the mindset in development from a project-based mentality that's producing such limited results to more of an investment mindset. Given all that is going wrong in the world right now, I expected this to be a depressing conversation, but I came out of it feeling hopeful. And I think you'll find there are some clear takeaways for everyone in the audience. I hope you enjoy. Raj, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the High Impact Growth Podcast. So I've been reading DevEx since I joined Damagi, which was about 2 years ago, and it's been so instrumental for me in just helping me understand the lay of the land and what's going on in the industry, and actually make every new hire on my team subscribe and read it daily. I know you've also written a book called The Business of Changing the World. You've also got a number of podcasts yourself, including the DevEx Book Club, which you just launched, which I'm excited about, and we'll share a link to in the show notes. But I'd love to kind of hear a little bit about your story, you know, before we get into nitty-gritty of what's happening in the aid world.
Yeah, sounds great. And great to be with you, Amy and John. It's really nice to have this conversation. The DevEx story, it's actually like an overnight success story that took 23 years. So, you know, a lot of people, DevEx kind of came onto their radar more recently. And they're like, oh, wow, you guys must be a startup. How did you do this so fast? And I was like, no, actually, this took a really long time. I started as a grad student. This was a student project 23 years ago. I was in grad school at Harvard's government school, the Kennedy School, and myself and some friends. And we were, you know, really thinking about how can you change the way the development sector works. And the way I kind of even got to that revelation was just wanting to get a job. You know, like I wanted to work in global development. I'd spent a little bit of my childhood in India. My dad was from India. I had an aunt and an uncle who were development scholars. They used to take me on village visits. So I had the bug, you know, I wanted to do something to make the world a better place. I wanted to work in, you know, places where there's a lot of disadvantages. And you know, I just thought like, all right, I'm in grad school. I'm in the right place to do this. You know, this has got to be easy. Like there's got to be a website I can go to and there'll be a list of jobs or a list of projects or a list of NGOs or, you know, the basic information. And I was totally shocked when I asked people about that. And they said, no, there's nothing like that. They basically, the advice I got was go to Washington, D.C. and go to cocktail parties. And that's how you get a job in global development. And I thought, can that really be the way this mission-driven sector works? And you know what? They weren't wrong. You know, I learned that. And I'd say it's still not completely different, but we have, I hope at DevEx tried to make a dent in that, you know, by saying, all right, we'll set up a kind of a neutral space, an online platform that can let any development professional around the world, whether you're in Washington, D.C. or you're, you know, closer where the work is, join, get access to basic information. And so we've grown from having, you know, all the jobs in development, all the funding, projects, grant opportunities, to a lot of news. And that's really what we're mainly known for now, is that we're an independent news organization. So we've got journalists all over the world writing about what are the big trends in global development, what's happening, trying to like lift up the stories of what's working, but also hold accountable the institutions that are failing. You know, and when things go wrong, talk about that, be honest that they went wrong and why. And because I think, you know, going back to when we first got started at DevEx, it wasn't like there were no newsletters, there was no information, but it was all coming out of communications departments of like the World Bank. And so it was a lot of happy stories about how things are working, you know, the glossy brochures, but there was not a real talk. The real talk happened privately. You know, it happened at the bar between aid workers who've been doing this a while and who really know what's going on. And we just said, we got to break that open. That's got to be out in the open. We got to put some sunlight on how the sector works. Don't sugarcoat it, but still understand it's critical work. It's absolutely essential. And that's why it's got to be done right. And so our tagline from the very beginning has been do good, do it well. if you are anywhere around the DevEx kind of, you know, ecosystem, you will see that tagline until you're sick of it. But we really believe in it. You know, it's this idea that it's not enough to try to do good. You've got to try to find the ways to do it as effectively as possible. And so that's a little bit better how we got to where we are.
Yeah, I love that, Raj, and that resonates a lot with, you know, where we're at strategically. And there's so many good ideas and visions out there and ways we can make change. And it's so hard to scale these things. You know, it's so hard to truly achieve high impact growth. And that's resonates a lot. One of the things, though, you know, I've been in this industry for 20 years and I've seen the overnight success of DevEx, and congrats on, you know, just amazing where everything's come to. When did that news component come in? And what was it like trying to start that up? And like, was there appetite for it initially? Because I think, you know, if you're a listener to this podcast, you know how broken certain aspects of this market can be and some of the challenges. And you've heard us speak with multiple guests about this. But I'm curious, having been the generator of a lot of this insight and truth, like, what was the reception when you first started doing this? And, you know, over the years, are people seeking out this information? Like, how does it land, I guess, you know, speaking truth to this industry?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would say, like, part of the reason it took so long for DevEx to scale is really the market, the community didn't accept us right away. They sort of thought, like, we heard a lot of good things, like you often do when you're trying to start something new. People are like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. But the truth was, most people, once we first launched, said, you know, we've been doing this 30 years. I've worked at UNICEF. I've worked at this NGO. I've worked in this space. And I know everybody. And I know everything. And, you know, we don't need a bunch of kids coming out of grad school with a website telling us information we know already. And the argument we were trying to make back then was, look, maybe you did. Maybe you did when global development was carved up into these tiny little fragmented pieces. You know, there was USAID and a small constellation of contractors and NGOs around it. But globalization is coming to global development too, you know, and this is becoming a big global market with way more players in it. And it's impossible to know everyone and everything. And if you want to do your work really effectively, it's even more important that you're reaching out and finding that next hire who is in the community you're trying to serve and not just another person sitting in Washington or London. So we tried to make that case. People were with us to a degree intellectually, but there are a lot of market drivers and forces that were just keeping the market the way it was. So that was part of the resistance. So like right from the beginning, we had some news. We had a newsletter. We'd go around and like gather up all the news we could find in the mainstream press that was related to global development. And we would summarize it, analyze it, put it in this newsletter. It was really popular. But after several years of growing the organization, growing our website and all the information we offered, we realized that it wasn't enough to say, we're democratizing jobs. Here are all the jobs. You can now see them. Or we're democratizing projects. You can see them all. What you really need was context. And that was missing. So if you weren't plugged in, you know, if you were a grad student somewhere else in the world, you didn't have professors who worked at the World Bank or the UN or something, you know, if you weren't plugged in, you didn't understand the context. When you see that job announcement or that project or read this one line of news, it's not enough. You're not going to understand it. You're not going to get what's going on. And that's when we realized, like, boy, you know, the news business is kind of broken. And you know, news organizations were going out of business. They were closing bureaus all over the world. You know, maybe this isn't a great business, but we got to find a way to make this work because the development sector desperately needs it. And so we started really small. We hired one editor, and then we later on hired one reporter. And we just kind of tried to figure out organically, how could we build a news organization that would be financially sustainable and would really serve the needs of this community and be true journalism, you know, like be hard hitting when we had to be hard hitting. And, you know, like anything else, it took some time for the community to kind of get what we were doing. And it took time for us to improve the quality of our reporting. And there were moments when early on we made mistakes or we would, you know, report on something, you know, a negative critical report that maybe we were right about, but the organizations we were writing about were surprised. Like they didn't know we were going to do that, right? But now we're well known as a news organization. So, you know, people expect that when they get a call from a DevEx reporter, like we're going to write a hard hitting story, and it doesn't mean we're out to get them or something, but we're, you know, our journalists come from the New York Times, they come from Reuters, they come from Bloomberg. Like those are the people who are on our team now. And it took a while to get there, but we figured out how to do it, I think, in the model. We're still growing, but that's kind of the backstory of how we got into it. It wasn't like day one. It took some time to build and grow organically.
You mentioned that context, and one of the things we wanted to talk about was that article that you wrote at the beginning of the year, setting up a context for, you know, kind of a new era of where we're heading as a development community. And I'd love to kind of hear your summary of that article, and then I want to dig into the key points that you mentioned on it.
Yeah, sure. So like I write a piece at the beginning of every year, and it's tempting every year to say, it's a new era, you know, like everything is going to change, or to say like, this is the most important year in development that's ever come. And there's some truth to that, right? Like every year that comes along, issues like climate get worse. So you can kind of see on the horizon and say, boy, this is different. But as I sat back and like spent the holiday break really thinking about some of the threads of the coverage we've done during the year, the conversations I've had, you know, one of the joys of my job is I get to interview, you know, I don't know, hundreds of people, talk to hundreds of people during the year, maybe thousands of people all over the world and get their take. And so trying to synthesize that together, I really began to come in to this idea that we are actually entering a new era, not just like a growing shift, not just a trend that's kind of accelerating, but like actually some fundamental shifts. And like anything else, you could see the history, the breadcrumbs of them in the past. They didn't just all happen January 1st, but like they are at a different stage, I think. So there's a few of them. I think one is the growing competition, even conflict with China, Russia, and the West, and that bleeding into the global development space. So that's like one really big picture one that I think there's a pretty fundamental shift that's happening. The second one is the global economy, like the macroeconomic conditions under which we have kind of gotten to know, like people like ourselves who've grown up in global development over the last two or three decades. We've known this is a space that had zero interest rates, money was cheap, Western donors were ready to ramp up their spending and their budgets. There were big new initiatives like PEPFAR. That's the era we've come from. We're entering a really different set of economic circumstances that I think is going to shift the era pretty dramatically. So that's a second big trend. And then the third one is that, you know, we've always had humanitarian response as a piece of the broader global development sector. They've always been somewhat siloed off. We talk about the nexus between humanitarian and development, but somewhat siloed off, and always, I don't know, around 10%, 15% of global development spending goes to humanitarian response. That has started to dramatically shift. And I think you can see the climate and the conflicts that are accelerating around the world, and you can see humanitarian response needing to get much bigger and beginning to almost swamp what we think of as global development. So those are the three big trends that I see really shifting. I don't think it's like a 2023 thing. I think it's a 2023 all the way to 2030 and maybe beyond. Like I think these are pretty big shifts, and I'm happy to get into them a little bit more, but that's kind of the big picture that I came to as I was working on that story.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I definitely agree with you. Every year you can say this is the most important year. I mean, we have just come out of COVID and you're seeing TB and HIV, you know, reverse course for the first time in decades. We have vaccination rates decreasing, and so the traditional stats are all looking daunting to begin with, you know, in terms of like this has to be a big year to recover. And then you layer on those three key critical areas. And one of the things I'm fascinated to hear, you know, how you think about this complexity, but we look at this challenge and say the only path out of this is 5x or 10x more value for money. Because as you said, the humanitarian needs are going to grow. They need a bigger part of the budget. The total number of people who need services and support is growing. Fortunately, we're seeing huge economic gains in massive markets like India and elsewhere. So that's a really positive part of this story. But we look at this and we're like, yeah, given those three convergent factors you mentioned, like we have to, as an industry, be getting massively more value for money. And one of the things that frustrates me personally is I look at some of the project designs and some of what governments are even asking for, and I'm like, you're asking for the wrong thing. Like we're in a new era. You need to be thinking about ways to get so much more than just a single project, you know, for $50 million. We have to be thinking about how we both get that project done and then layer on this foundation, right? This change. And I think that foundational thinking to me is we're early in this journey, you know, as an industry and as Damaki, but I'm like, there's just no chance we're solving this, right? with a project-based mindset anymore. And I'm curious, like, how you think about that.
Yeah, that's it. You know, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Business of Changing the World. And in that, part of what I'm talking about is this like broader revolution in the way we do development, the kind of how of our industry. And that's one of the key points I make in that book is that, you know, if you go to you name the capital city, Kigali, right? In especially donor darling countries where there's a lot of aid work going on. And you go to the international hotel, you go to the bar where everybody hangs out, and there are these places, right? And you tap on somebody's shoulder and say, hey, what's going on? The conversation is always based around a project. It's like, hey, what are you doing? Oh, I'm here on this new project. Or, we're re-upping this project, or here to monitor this project, right? Like, it's all about a project. That's our unit of activity. Maybe on Wall Street, it's trades or something, right? Every industry has their unit of activity. In development is projects. And I think that is a huge thing holding us back. It's like the wrong mindset. It's the wrong measure of success. It's the wrong unit of activity. And we're there in part because of the reality that historically most of the money was coming through government agencies. And government procurement is naturally project oriented, right? They can't fund something forever, so they're thinking about a timeline. They have to have a budget. It can't be kind of loosey-goosey. They got to say, this is the amount. They need to define it really well because it's taxpayer money. You got to know what you're buying, and you need to have a lot of controls around that and risk mitigation. So that's kind of why we got into this, I think, is government money for good reasons is spent in this way. And it just doesn't fit the needs that we're talking about. It just doesn't work. So a lot of good things happened out of projects. It's not like they've all failed, but they are just not suited to the realities on the ground in terms of what people need. And so that shift is going to be very, very tough. Now, a couple of things have changed, and I get into that in my article versus when I wrote the book. So one big one is because of the economic circumstances and the humanitarian needs growing, rich country governments in the West, the US, Germany, UK, et cetera, they're basically cutting aid budgets or plateauing aid budgets at the same time as the amount they have to spend, the proportion they have to spend on humanitarian is growing fast. So what does that mean? It means there's very little left for development. That amount is going to shrink and shrink and shrink. So where is the development funding going to come from? I think there's basically two other sources that are now going to get front and center in our sector. One is the multilateral development banks and this really big push to totally reform them. Take them from being bankers to countries, lending money to build a road or something, to being more like deal makers, more like investment bankers, where they say, all right, how do we help electrify your transportation system in your country? We're not going to do it. We're just going to provide some expertise. We're going to provide some risk capital. We'll take some of the first losses. We'll guarantee some of the investments. But it's really private companies, private sector, private investment that'll do it with the government of that country. So the MDB reform is a potentially really big idea to crowd in a lot of money and corporate expertise into development work from a slightly different angle, but really big in health, really big in clean water and sanitation. It could be big in transportation, renewable energy, and those sectors that have some kind of business model behind them, where you can generate some revenue. And then the other space is going to be philanthropy. And philanthropy has been threatening for a long time to get big. It hasn't really quite done it, with a few exceptions. But I think it's really going to come. And part of my thesis here is not just that there's so many billionaires in the world and 10% of them or so have signed the giving pledge, and so they're kind of on the hook to do something. But part of my theory is, with the economy shifting as it is, there's just going to be more and more pressure on taxation in a lot of the rich countries. And at some point, something's got to give, and it's not going to be as easy as it's been to just park billions of dollars in foundations and not spend it, or just hang on to it and not spend it. There's going to be some real pressure to quickly, before tax law shifts, get money into vehicles that are protected from tax, but that then, by new rules, have to start spending out that money more quickly. I think that's coming. I think billionaires see that writing on the wall already. And I think they're gearing up to do a lot more. So I think there'll be a flood of billionaire spending. I mean, the Gates Foundation alone is going to be at $9 billion annually in 2 years. That's versus the UK, what the UK actually spends globally, not just on domestic things like refugees in their border. They might be bigger than the UK. I mean, it's pretty amazing. One foundation. So I think that a big part of it is the nature of the money coming to the space is going to be really different. And that might help get to your point, John, about the project nature of our industry, because the philanthropy money doesn't have to be project-based. A lot of it is, but it doesn't have to be. And the private sector money also can have a different feature to it, right? These can be more like business models that you're investing in, like you're investing in the water system of a country or the transport system. You're not doing one-off projects necessarily. So I think there's a chance in this transition to try to frame this and make it work in a way that's more connected to the needs on the ground and in countries right now.
Yeah, I love that. And just to replay a couple of things you mentioned there that I think are critical. One is this project-based funding problem is not a symptom of something broken. It is the way taxpayer-funded things happen, right? You have to have, like, for all the reasons you just mentioned. So when we're talking about foreign donor assistance from formal governments backed by taxpayer dollars, it is really difficult to get out of the project-based funding mechanism. And so what we need to be considering and looking to is maybe we accept that that's how that money is going to get deployed. And we say, how do we generate huge impact with that money, but also looking at the alternative two mechanisms you mentioned? And I think that point around both the existing foundations growing substantially, but as you mentioned, we have a lot of challenges in Western countries, the U.S. specifically. You know, it's huge looming problems with Social Security and growing unfunded liabilities. And to your point, like, either we're going to back out of those liabilities or tax rates are going to go up a lot, for certain demographics in the United States.
And things like foreign aid might go down, right? I mean, certainly before you cut Social Security benefits, right? Like, the political demands are going to be very powerful there.
That's right. And then, as you mentioned, urgent humanitarian crises that are on TV, that really are have a major constituency, are obviously going to outstrip long-term development planning when push comes to shove and they become political issues. And so I think that backdrop is so interesting that you tied that together and really prescient for also what's happening in the technology world with this explosion of AI. And, you wrote this article before technology looked like it was about to be, once in an era transformation. But Bill Gates released a note, about this is, one of the major technology changes he thinks we're ever going to go through. And so that all coming together to me, it's both scary, in a lot of ways, looking at what's going on and the rate of change in technology, but it's also incredibly exciting as a potential answer to this new era or a potential contributing support factor to this new era. So I'm curious, what are the technology discussions you're having? How are you thinking about technology in the backdrop of what you just mentioned?
Yeah, two quick thoughts about that. So one, just going back to what you were saying about the project funding from bilateral donors like USAID, I think even within their constraints, there's a lot more they can be doing to get away from their traditional project model. I mean, you have things like the Development Innovation Ventures, DIV, which is like a tiered funding approach. And that has helped launch a whole bunch of, groups like yours that do tech-based, social enterprise work. The U.S. government can take a small risk, $50,000, see if you get to a milestone, then take a $300,000 risk, then maybe later $1 million risk as you show progress. I think there's still a lot of innovation where even if development funding becomes 30% or something or 20% of total foreign aid, it could be spent a lot better. There are other ways to do it. So I don't want to let them off the hook on that, And then this is my second point, and a lot of that might be around technology, by the way. So my second point would be when it comes to the revolution in tech, I think a lot of it's unlocking the potential of the people who are closest to the problems, right? So think about community health workers. They're there, they know the situation well, they have certain skills. What can you do to just get way more out of that person, make them much more productive? And I think historically we felt like tech is just, it's cumbersome, it's expensive. It's like, and I remember going to Ethiopia and meeting with somebody who's an education expert working there, and he gave me like 10 reasons why they've tried to use tablets in the schools and it just failed, And they're all good reasons. But it does feel like we're hitting this tipping point where the price curve on hardware, point hardware where people can put in their hand a smartphone or a tablet or whatever, wearables, it's just getting really cheap. And we're also at a point where the computing power at the edge of the network is getting really powerful. And the idea you could use something like a ChatGPT in the hands of a community health worker and use it as a diagnostic tool, use it as a tool to even prescribe like basic healthcare advice to people. Like there's a lot. And if you can get wearables really cheap and you know use sensors to find out how the patient is doing, like you could just imagine really unlocking massive potential without having to wait for skilling up and training up a whole new generation of nurses and doctors, you know, which is going to be very tough to do given the demographic issues, right? So, yeah, I think the potential is absolutely massive. And so now the question is, how do you create the business models so that there's actual incentive to grow into this and to get companies like yours to build the solutions using the latest tech? And that's where like the MDB reform is really big. That's where philanthropy can be really big, looking at these as sectors and like how do you unlock them. I was just in Medellin recently and I was meeting with a social entrepreneur who is working in the electrification of cars space, right? So he's like, look, places like Medellin, places in South America and Latin America, we're probably not ever going to be rich enough to just get rid of all of our gas guzzling cars and buses and just buy Teslas. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen on the time scale that is needed to cut emissions or to reduce pollution in cities. So it's like the other thing we can do instead is take these old cars, swap out the motors for electric motors, swap out the gas tank, put in a battery. So that's what he's trying to do. And he's doing, he's built a business doing that. But he's got to buy the battery from Tesla and he's got to buy the electric motors from China. And there's another company like that in Argentina. There's one in Uruguay. Like people are trying to do this. And the new era I'm envisioning is one where the World Bank, with a foundation backing them, with the government, like a progressive minister of transport in a certain country, they get together and say, how do we build like an electrification of gas guzzlers across three countries? Build a whole market. We know we're going to need like charging stations. We're going to need battery production factories. We're going to need electric motor factories. We're going to need this whole like broad mindset. But there's a business here. This is not just a gift. There's a business. We might need the foundation to be willing to throw some money in the beginning, technical assistance, some grants, help get some social entrepreneurs going that are going to lose money. Like they're going to just do some big grants. Those will go away. They won't get that money back. We might need the World Bank to guarantee some private investors and they might lose something on that. But it's a different mindset, I think. I don't think we think about this in development. And it is very much with the technology and a business model at the center.
I love that. And we'll drop a link to the show notes, but DevX wrote an article on one of our major new initiatives that's very much aligned to what you were saying, Raj, around how do we change that model and unlock the potential of those frontline workers. And I think that we're seeing that in high income markets too, right? There's been this huge shift around really going back to industrial policy, you know, whether that's chip manufacturing in Western markets, whether that's China just exploding with what they've been doing around EV vehicles and solar and these things. So you're seeing that strategy happen at high-income country levels. And I completely agree, doing that at the development sector and looking at not a project base, but how do we turn Malawi into a leader in X or Zambia into a leader in Y? And you're going to have to come across all of those different parts of money that you mentioned. You know, that grant funding, the first loss backing, the loan and the equity all coming together in a stack that makes sense for all the participants. And I think one of the things that drives me crazy is you have to do all of that and then recognize some of the market is just traditional development after that, right? So if you build all that infrastructure, part of it is driving vaccines to more remote areas that don't have petrol, and you can sell that to Gavi. And what I think makes this challenging to have a lot of the time and be innovative is the second you say that, people are like, oh, you don't have a sustainable model, right? And you're like, no. This is totally sustainable. We need to deliver vaccines every year forever with this model. So it's okay that part of my funding for this model is coming from the traditional sector for that project-based approach. But I totally agree. That's not sustainability. That's a market, right? That's the project-based market. And I need all this other capital to build the foundation, the platform, the tech, the people, the charging stations, et cetera. But I really like the way you articulated that.
You got to find the places where there is a business model, where there is some potential revenue, and make sure you're using those opportunities so that you can save the precious grant dollars for things like vaccine delivery, where there isn't going to be a direct business model. You're not going to charge people for vaccines. There's an indirect one because people are healthy, can work, be productive, pay taxes. The government can make money through taxation and fund the vaccines, right? So there's a virtuous cycle, but it's not so direct. Whereas in the water space, you know, people are right now spending money out of pocket to buy water, have water trucks come to their house or something, or buy jerry cans full of water. So you could potentially say, all right, instead of paying for that, we can build a long-term sustainable solution, water infrastructure, or it's piped into your community or into your home. So we had to use those opportunities so that we can save the precious $8, which really are very precious, for the right things, a lot of which I think are around health and education. And you're going to, even in health, there are plenty of things that have business models, but you know, there's a lot that won't. I'm absolutely with you on this. I think it requires something of a shift in the way we've been thinking as an industry. You know, to your point about industrial policy, one of the factors I mentioned at the beginning, those three factors that are changing this new era, shaping this new era, one is this Cold War with China. Maybe we're not all the way in a Cold War yet, but boy, it feels like we're getting there. And if one of the features of that is, I think, industrial policy that we're seeing in the U.S., CHIPS Act, we're seeing in Europe, that is going to extend into global development because all the things we're talking about have a technology backbone. And right now, a lot of that technology backbone is coming from China. Like Huawei provides much cheaper handsets than anybody else in the world. So a lot of this is going to come from there. And, you know, development agencies are waking up to this. There's already, you know, congressional rules and things around this. But I feel like there will be a time soon, or there will be a trend in the direction of aid agencies saying, hang on a second, we want to do digital health, but who's manufacturing the routers? Who's providing the internet connection? What's the handset? What software are we using? Okay, we want to do industrial policy. We want to guide this because we want it to be our stuff, you know, or from stuff from our neighbors and allies. And so I have a feeling this is going to extend right into all the sectors we're talking about because it's going to be driven from the really strong political imperative, which is China. If you want to sell anything on Capitol Hill right now related to global development, it's saying, hey, this is a way to confront China. That's the sale. That's the only thing that is bipartisan. It's the only thing that gets everybody together right now. And I think that's going to continue.
Rajan, within that context of this new Cold War, one of the things that you wrote about in your piece was around localization, which I know is a big push right now from USAID, so kind of from that government money. I'm curious to hear your take on, like, how do you see that playing out? What's the ideal scenario for what's possible there, and what are some of the things that you're worried about there?
Yeah, I think, you know, most everybody in this space wants localization. Like, they're like, yeah, this is good. We want this. Even maybe surprisingly, organizations that will lose money. Some of like the really big NGOs, you know, I'm friends with probably a lot of the CEOs of the big international NGOs. They're all big advocates for localization. And I say to them, you know, you're going to lose money. The funding is not going to flow through you. If we can figure out how to do this better through local organizations, they, yeah, it's fine. Like they get it because they're committed to the broader goal and everybody's frustrated with this project approach and the way it works, right? So there's real consensus there. I think the problem is when we say localization, that's not really the thing that's going to get us to the results that John is talking about. When you say, hey, we've got 5x, 10x returns on the precious, you know, foreign assistance dollars we have, we need a more fundamental shift, which is the shift to like paying for results. Or, you know, the other buzzwords like impact economy, right? Where it's like we're buying a result, we're buying health, we're buying education, we're not buying a project that spits out a report at the end, whether or not it actually worked. And that shift is more fundamental than localization. So if localization becomes, okay, there's a target, and instead of giving project dollars to a US-based company or NGO, we're going to give it to a, you know, Zimbabwean-based company or NGO, that, you know, maybe that's a mild, marginal improvement, but it's pretty small. The thing we're really after is a more fundamental shift if we want to see this step change. So, you know, I think it's going to be very hard to get that done because of all the things we just talked about with the nature of the government model. But the reason I don't want to let them off the hook on this, and I'm not talking just about U.S. government, I'm talking about all bilateral donors, I think there's an opportunity vis-a-vis the conflict with China to say, hey, what makes Western aid different is that we are thinking about long-term sustainability by being community-driven and by connecting with the private sector. And instead, what we get from the more Chinese model might be, okay, no strings attached, we do what the government wants, but you're not getting long-term sustainability because you're getting a lot of Chinese labor, you're getting projects that are infrastructure-focused that support a Chinese economic model, but you're not getting what you need to grow your own country and economy and citizenry. And so maybe there's some way we can position the offering that comes from Western donors in a different way that encompasses these changes we're talking about, and that makes that's even more compelling than just localization, right? I'm hopeful there may be something like that, something more on innovation, sustainability, locally driven solutions, you know, payment for results, that could become like a signifying difference. And then if that's true, then you can build some political support for that and maybe get some of the reforms you need for bilateral donors and the people who run them to have the flexibility that, frankly, they want and they wish they had to do this. Like, a lot of people work at USAID or FCDO or you name it. They would love nothing more than to change the way they work, but they don't have the staff to do it, the capacity, the authorities. Like, they're just laboring under really challenging circumstances. So maybe there's a way in this new era to shift that.
I like that. And the not letting them off the hook, you've used that phrase a few times, and I think that's definitely something I'm taking away of thinking through, because we often talk about this in the digital space of, like, we're letting people off too easy. You know, we're all accountable for trying, but nobody's accountable for actually succeeding. And we think it's kind of like just too low of a bar, you know, we've set for these digital health projects. Like, we can get way more out of these dollars. Now, yes, it does require different partnership models. Yes, it does require better localization. Yes, it does require breaking out of project funding. But for the amount that we're spending on digital, we could be getting a lot more value for money, you know, in our opinion. And we're going to have to, right? We're going to have to get this 5x or 10x result given what we're facing.
That's right. And I think it does require that looking at these problems from a higher level. Because once you get down to the project level, it's very tempting to say, oh, yeah, all these other health, digital health projects have failed. Look at them. They spent a lot of money. They didn't do that much. So we've got the new idea. We know how to do it. Let's do something a little bit different this time. And you don't realize it, but what you're actually doing is doing another pilot. You know, because you're doing something small and it may not scale. And so somehow you need to get the foundations to drop a little bit of their ego, do more collaborative philanthropy. And some of that's happening, not enough, I think, but some of it is. So, you know, give up the need to get the credit, to say we're the innovative ones, like get a few foundations together, get a few bilaterals together, get the right governments or the right, you know, progressive ministers together in the right places and say, hey, we could do something at scale. What would it be like to design this thing for scale right from the beginning? Okay, to do that, maybe we need a lot more money. Who are the private sector investors who could invest in this? Who are the tech companies we could partner with right from the start and build a model that could actually have a shot at scaling and take a much bigger bet based on all the learnings we've had of all the digital health projects that haven't really gone to scale? I don't know. You're closer to this, John, than me because you work in this every day. But I just feel like our ambition sometimes is too small.
I totally agree. I think that notion of taking bigger bets is critical. And I acknowledge not everybody has the funding or the ability to take those big bets. But what we often are doing too, as you mentioned, is taking a really small bet and thinking we're taking a big bet. And that's extremely harmful, because then what happens is people look at that and they're like, well, this big thing didn't pay off. You're like, no. You put $500,000 behind that with very little thought, very little effort. It was basically the same thing all over again. Like, we shouldn't have expected a different outcome. And I think that's why I'm excited by some of the work that CoDevelop is doing around digital public infrastructure. You see this amazing work happening in India around the health stack and the work they're doing. And we're starting to see these shifts in these bigger investments, taking bigger bets, and they're working. You know, not every time, and we're going to have huge amounts of failure. But what often happens, and you know, this is the part of the world that you work in all the time with the bigger INGOs and things, you're kind of forced to pretend like everything's a sure thing. You're not even allowed to say it's a bet in the first place, right? You're like, okay, this new project, of course it's going to work. Give me $50 million and I guarantee this outcome in 5 years. And then you get a 50% failure rate on these projects or even higher. But when you write that next grant, you're still presenting it like a sure thing, right? So the other thing that I think would be really healthy and helpful is acknowledging these are bets, right? Like we are, in fact, all taking bets on the likelihood of new technologies or new things. Like some things are sure things, but those are few and far between. And they need to potentially get even fewer and further between, given the magnitude of the problem we face. But so much of the time, you're forced to pretend like the thing you're proposing to do is definitely going to work, right?
Another word for a bet is an investment, right? Investments can succeed, they can fail. If you're in venture capital, most of them fail, but you're looking for a couple that really succeed. If you're in private equity, you want more of them to succeed, right? But they don't all have to. So it depends like where you're coming from. But if you're in a foundation, you can afford to really lose the money. I mean, you're spending it anyway, and you can therefore take some of that risk away from some of the investors, depending where they are in that stack that we're talking about. And so yeah, I think an investment mindset is maybe even better than a bet mindset. You know, like take an investment mindset to digital health in India. And like you probably know the case of India way better than me, but my understanding is like some of the big Indian telecom companies saw the business opportunity to give away free phones and free data access to people living in poverty because they said, hey, this is actually good business for us because, you know, maybe they can't pay today, but they'll start paying for data in 2 or 3 years and we'll be able to get the information about who they are and sell other services to them. And so one reason why in a market like India, you could potentially do digital health work at a really high scale is because that digital infrastructure has been rolled out by private companies trying to make money. And that's kind of my point is we should be partnering with those companies. We should be thinking about this at this higher level and figure out how do you roll out right at the start digital health services as somebody's getting that phone from Reliance, right? So I just think like there's a different mindset needed, this investment mindset. And if we can get there, we can maybe get to some of the 5X, 10X returns that you mentioned at the start.
Absolutely. And I think that investment mindset and framing is critical because for the investments to work, people also have to acknowledge 4 out of 5 are going to fail. And that is currently very challenging for anybody to accept because this isn't how we're structuring our thinking or the portfolio or thinking at that higher level. But when you take kind of that holistic approach you were talking about with looking at the entire industry or taking 3 countries and really putting a package together, you might have 10, components in there, and if 7 succeed, you hit a home run. But that still means 3 are outright failing, 3 are probably like, marginally good and 4 work. But again, like the whole industry kind of pretends as if everything's going to work. And you can't have these honest conversations about the level of risk. And that makes it very difficult to unlock this different way of thinking. And I'm totally aligned to how you're thinking about that problem and speaking about it. And that's one of the things we face as a challenge because technology has huge potential. And it's not a software issue. It's a governance issue. It's a use case issue. It's an adoption challenge. So you could have perfect technology and it can still fail. But people will often blame the technology and then say, oh, that thing doesn't work. And it's like, well, that didn't work in that use case. But this like platform theory or this public infrastructure theory is still a very good one. And we need to look at and learn from what didn't work. And one of the things I've tried to see if some of the bilaterals could think through more fully is there's this learning agenda that's required to have an investment mindset, right? You have to like figure out why did that not work? And you have to also think it was worth the failure, right? Like what I learned from that is now going to make me smarter in the future. And that's now going to give me ultimately a higher return for my taxpayer dollars that I'm putting in. So even if this innovation on PEPFAR or Global Fund didn't have the outcome I wanted, as long as we actually learned successfully from that and had honest conversations the whole way, that will ultimately hopefully drive to future innovation that does in fact make that failure positive ROI, even for taxpayers, right? Much less investors.
Yep. Yeah, I think, maybe what we need is for some of these bilaterals to say, we don't need to be driving this. We don't need to be in the driver's seat. We don't need to like figure out the problem, define it, define the solution. right? And then take this bet. Maybe what we need is sometimes the humility to say, like, there are other organizations that know this way better. And some of those would be foundations, like the Gates Foundation, right? And say, hey, you guys know this way better. What do you think we should do? Like, let's think at this really high level. And then we in the Danish government or the Norwegian government or the US government, like, we'll back that. And maybe multiple bilaterals will back that big initiative. But we don't have to, like, own it. It doesn't have to be ours. And I think if you can get there, you can get away from this pilot problem we've got where everybody wants to do their own thing. They want to take credit for it. They want to put their brand on it. They think it's their job to solve the problem, right? And I just don't think it always is.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the notion that you had around pay for results also has a huge contributing factor, because when you're stuck in this project approach and constantly restarting the next thing, you're paid for starting the project, right? As opposed to being paid for succeeding at achieving the outcome you said you would. And that, you know, I've found that in the technology space, I assume this is true in other sectors, it completely messes up your brain. Like, it's this toxic thought that's always in your head when you know the money's in starting the next project as opposed to making sure your current project is actually successful, because it causes you to underinvest in partnering, causes you to underinvest in the ecosystem. And again, I don't think this is unique to technology. It's a disease of the project mindset, and it causes just huge lost opportunity along the way because you're constantly defending the project as opposed to achieving the outcome, right? And that's something that I think is so important to unlock, because again, for the same amount of money, if you can change that mindset, you're going to find so much leverage and partnership opportunity, and localization is going to happen naturally because that's actually the better way to get a lot of this done in the first place.
Exactly. Right. If you're paying for results and there's a real marketplace for that, and it's like, all right, who's got the cheapest intervention that's most likely to work to raise literacy rates? Chances are they're going to be heavily locally, you know, implemented. Like, that's just the reality. So if you can get to pay for results, you probably achieve localization anyway, versus the way that we may end up doing it right now, like in the US, which is more around, we're going to set some rules. We're going to change the rules of the contracting game. And that's going to just push more money to local contractors. That's not actually what we're trying to do, I don't think. It doesn't really connect to the ultimate goal.
Well, they're still executing what the US decided should be happening, right? They're executing on the project.
That's right.
I think this is really fascinating. I've been, like, just learning so much listening to you both. And it sounds like there's a few themes coming out of this in terms of how we need to shift things. I hear you, Raj, talking about collaboration. We need to be getting together and looking at what works. I also heard you talk about humility, which, you know, one of my theories of the world is just that, like, egos are at the heart of, like, so many of our problems.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Amy.
and we all kind of need to have that humility to work together and to be honest about what's working. I also love this idea of this kind of shifting to more of an investment mindset, and what does it look like to pay for results as opposed to projects. And I'm curious, Raj, in closing, like, what are some of your key messages? If you think about our audience in sort of two groups, like technology implementers and technologists, you know, working at organizations like Demagi, and then also I think we've got a funder audience as well. Like, what do you want each of those groups to be thinking about and doing differently to take us forward?
I guess I would love the technologists to think about solving a problem in development the same way you would think about solving a problem in a rich country market. Like, if you're going to try to solve a problem for, you know, some wealthy zip code in Silicon Valley, how do you go about doing that? Okay, now think about that for a low resource setting. Do it the same way, you know? So if you would go and talk to customers and ask them what they think, figure out how much they're willing to pay for the service, figure out what their existing level of digital connectivity or literacy or whatever it is, do the same thing in a low resource setting. And help basically have the people themselves design their own solution, like tell you what they need, what their pain points are, and have them design the solution. And then I'd say to the funders, when the technologists do that, listen to them, you know, like fund those ideas, those businesses, because they're kind of like businesses. They might not all generate revenue, but fund those ideas that are going to have a kind of market mechanism built in, because they're demand driven. And don't force them into your box. Don't say, like, no, well, we're going to do a project and it's going to have this timeline. Find a way within the authorities you have to give them, the technologists, the social entrepreneurs, to give them what they need to be successful. And I really believe a lot of donors, funders, they're doing this. They're trying. I think they need to step it up. There's more to do, but there are a lot of the authorities are there. A lot of the models exist. This is not all brand new, and plenty of people have been doing it. So it's just time to really step it up.
All right. So on that note, we're going to ask everybody to step it up who's listening. And Raj, we really appreciate your time joining us today. Thank you for the wise words, and great to catch up as always.
Thank you. Thanks, Amy. Thanks, John. It's been fun.
I'll share my takeaways. We heard from Raj about his experience creating DevEx and how his team has successfully made the aid industry more inclusive, accessible, and honest. Before DevEx, communication was dominated by world banks and other funders telling rosy stories of success. DevEx bridged the gap for honest journalism, and I highly recommend subscribing to their newswire. Looking ahead, 2023 marks a pivotal year for the development industry. Raj highlights three converging factors: a new Cold War for foreign aid, a new economic backdrop, and accelerating humanitarian needs due to climate and conflicts. John and Raj conclude that because of all these shifts, the only path to reasonably meeting the growing needs globally is getting 5 or 10x more value for money. And doing that requires a shift in mindset. From a traditionally project-based mindset, which is just not working, to more of an investment mindset. Raj breaks down three types of funders and shifts that are or need to happen. He talks about traditional government donor funding and how it's shrinking, and encourages government donors to consider new ways of investing in development beyond the project-based mold. Next, he talks about multilateral development banks that are undergoing a transformation to more of an investment-focused business model. And he also talks about philanthropy, which he sees as poised for growth. 10% of billionaires have signed the Giving Pledge, and they're under more and more pressure from taxation to spend it more quickly. And the beauty of philanthropic funding is that it can happen at the platform level. Raj's closing message is that technologists need to operate in development the same way that they would operate in high-income settings. Understand the problem deeply and develop solutions. And funders need to listen to the technologists doing that and invest in them. Technology is at a true tipping point. It's getting cheaper and more powerful with increasing ability to unlock the potential. We have the opportunity and the need to get more value for money across the board. That's our show. Please like, rate, review, subscribe, and share this episode if you found it useful. And write to us at podcast@demangi.com with any ideas, comments, or feedback. This show is executive produced by myself. Danielle Van Wyk is our producer, Brianna DeRoos is our editor, and cover art is by Sivan Chakan.